We have something called the Max Fun Drive here at the Maximum Fun Network. Happens once a year. It's when we do the vast majority of our online fundraising. Don't worry, it's not going on right now. During the drive, all the shows create special content. We try to get big name guests. We hit social media platforms super hard, and we set goals for the number of new contributors to our shows. And after I have set that goal here for my show, I turn a huge crank wheel and I open up a massive coursing flood of anxiety. Anxiety that shoots out like water through a hydroelectric dam, or like a hydroelectric dam that is collapsing. This anxiety spigot dam water thing is a metaphor. Now, I was in public radio for 20 years. I've been on the mic for many a member drive. I know that if you ask people to donate, they will, and thank you if you have. But if I'm not careful, I start equating the number of people who support the show with a kind of quantitative measure of my self-worth. It's messed up. That anxiety, worrying about that kind of thing, about those goals and about that self-measurement, that anxiety is part of what's called a cognitive distortion. And yes, I'm aware of it. I pay attention to mental health things as part of my existence on Earth and part of my work, which includes this here podcast. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. Now, here's another weird part of what we're doing here. It's possible that you and I, you the listener, and me, John, exist in a kind of parasocial relationship. I talk into your headphones and I get deeply personal, but you probably don't talk into my headphones. You and I would probably get along, but we don't actually know each other, at least not yet. Anyway, so during the last Max Fun Drive, I said that if we reached our goal, I'd release an episode with Justin McElroy of the hugely popular My Brother, My Brother and Me podcast. And we hit the goal, and here we are. And you know what I've already done? I've foreshadowed the rest of the interview. Because Justin has been dealing with an anxiety disorder and living within parasocial relationships for years, even as he's been part of a real empire of podcasts on Maximum Fun, which are supported by your donations, which I'm assuming he gets anxious about. See, it all comes around. He hosts My Brother, My Brother and Me with his brothers, Travis and Griffin McElroy. It's a kind of comedic advice program. Justin also co-hosts the Sawbones podcast. It's a medical podcast, and he does that with his wife, Dr. Sydney McElroy. He's the co-host of Adventure Zone, a role-playing game podcast with Griffin, Travis, and their dad, Clint. There are lots of other McElroy family podcasts, but my God, I don't have all day. Some families run furniture stores. These guys make podcasts. On My Brother, My Brother and Me, or Mabimbam, as the fans abbreviate it, the guys have a somewhat tongue-in-cheek slogan of no bummers. But Justin's on my show now, and there will be bummers. A while back, Justin McElroy opened up about his full history with anxiety on the Sawbones podcast, told his wife and listeners all about it. I asked what led to that openness and how he feels about it now.
It was a time where I was looking to other people who I felt like had some of the similar struggles as I do, because it was, you know, like a lot of these things, it ebbs and flows, and it was real bad. And hearing people that seem to be happy, or at least, you know, not struggling in that moment, gave me some hope that, like, there is a way back to that. So, yeah, I mean, I felt like if I could be that person for somebody, then that was sort of the least I could do. So
how has the response been?
Really good. I mean, really, like, you know, people seem to appreciate, you know, more voices that are open to talking about this. And I feel like the more that I can sort of bring it up and sort of joke about it, makes it maybe seem a little less scary. It's also, I'm somebody who's constantly looking for better ways of dealing with not just anxiety, but just, you know, life in general. And I feel like if I find something that is helpful to me, you know, I want to be able to mention it. You know, when you get to something that's actually really true, then I think it feels good to get that out there.
How far back does the anxiety go, or at least the anxiety where you can notice it, where it becomes an obstacle, where it becomes an issue that you've had to deal with?
I think it's in my wiring. I can remember being very young. I mean, probably 8 years old, 9 years old, and crying in my bedroom to my parents because I had so many things that I needed to do in Final Fantasy on the Nintendo Entertainment System. I had so many things I had to do in Final Fantasy that I was crying about it. And it's like, whoa, buddy, I wish we had been a little bit more smarter about mental illness back then, because you probably would have been on a good path.
Yeah, that game that you're playing to have fun, you are now crying about in your bed.
I'm now crying over because I have too many activities. I started to actually like recognize what was going on with me and seeking help. It was weird. My wife is a physician who is trained in like tropical medicine and medicine in areas where resources are slight. So she was going to go to Honduras for a month, and I was going to go with her, and in a massive, as somebody who's like sort of comfort obsessed, like a massive shift for me. And I started worrying about everything all the time, not just that, to a point where it was like, this is impeding my day-to-day life. I mean, this is getting in the way of me being a happy person. I was probably 30. And then it was like things were a little bit calmer for a few years. And then I was about to have my first child. I wasn't. My wife was. I was about to be present for the birth of my first child.
You were about to be a helper.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I was about, yes, exactly. And I started like getting extremely, I would have daily, I mean, daily is not even, I mean, multiple times daily about, it was the first Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2014, where in Crimea, I guess. And I was constantly having these like daily panic attacks about World War III starting and like, that nuclear war that was a big thing for me, and it was constant in my head 5, 6, 7 times a day, stopping everything that I was doing. And it was like, it took me literally years after that to start to connect the dots between like, wait a minute, that's a massive life change, and that's a massive life change, and that's, wait a minute, maybe there's a connection here. I feel like there's something, some sort of like connective tissue between these.
Yeah, all crises become part of one large meta crisis.
Exactly. I've skillfully woven these into a tapestry of bad feelings.
Found connective tissue where none existed before.
But so I mean, it's been, I guess, a good 10 years for me of like actively working to manage my anxiety and learn to live with it and tease out the parts that are me just being an annoying person and me being an anxious person, right? Like my insistence that my wife asked me to, she was pouring the cream in my coffee this morning, and she said, you know, say when. I said, wait, did you put, you have to put a layer of ice cubes in, and then you put the cream on top of that, so you know, that's the only way I know exactly how much cream. And there was a moment where I was like, gosh, this darn anxiety has gotten me again. It's like, no, you're just a creep. Like, there's some things you're just a creep about. You're just an annoying jerk who's very particular about the amount of cream in his coffee. Of course, she very smartly handed it to me and said, okay, you do it. I was like, all right, got it. Perfect.
While someone is doing something kind for you.
You're
not doing kindness in the right way.
Yes, that's not. What if it's too creamy? That'll set my whole day out in a wrong direction.
So you talk about this kind of coming to a head when you turned 30 or so. Yeah. Had you been just putting up with it until then, or keeping it at bay? Did you have coping mechanisms of your own?
I think that things were so, I really drifted for a long time, and not in a way that was just very sort of, I guess it's implied by drifting, but very aimless. not really knowing what I wanted to do with my life. And I think that the stakes were low enough as a result of that, that I didn't, you know, not the sort of like panic, more obvious anxiety. I was definitely bad with, have always been, and continue to be sort of like not great with crowds, not great with large groups of people. And that was really how the anxiety manifested at that point, which was a sort of low level distaste for being, you know, extended party scenarios is just not really my thing. And constantly in my head about, I think a lot of people who have social anxiety, like I do, they get a bad rap in that they find it distasteful. And there are certainly times where that is the case. But for me, it was a lot more like, I just want to do it. If I knew it was going to go perfectly and I was going to walk away with this stranger thinking that I am smart and funny and kind and they want to be my friend, if I knew it would always work that way, I'd love to have more conversations with people. You know what I mean? I'd love that. I used to do, I was a sort of a general beat reporter in various newspapers in my 20s. And I frequently would get sent to, you know, a crime scene or the scene of a fire or anything really, anywhere that news was. And I would have to just kind of walk around like with a pad in my hand, hoping someone would make eye contact with me. So I would say, yeah, I'm a reporter. Okay, good. Okay. It was a terrible fit for me.
Yeah, the mark of a great reporter, excessive timidity.
Exactly. Right.
Being very reticent.
Why was I allowed to do that? I was terrible. I was terrible at it. Yes, I was miserable with that. But yeah, it was much more social, I think, in earlier, because things seemed low stakes for me. That didn't change until I was 25 when my mom passed away. And that really, I think, was an interesting – that's at the root of a lot of it, but in such a boring way that I don't really – or an obvious way, I guess, more accurately, that I don't really like spend a lot of time thinking about it. But that really like started me thinking about how, you know, permanence and impermanence and the fact that like I needed to do something, you know, I needed to have some sort of direction or I was just sort of going to wander. And that was really a moment where it started to seem very real. The stakes started to seem very real in life. And that was probably the root of a lot of the anxiety that I'm currently enjoying now.
So because your mom had passed, you began to think about like, okay, what's my mission on earth? Like, oh, life is finite. I better make my mark. Was that it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, really, and professionally, but also like I got married the year after that. I had a moment, not to get too heavy, but I guess this is depression mode if you're going to do it somewhere.
Yeah. All bummers.
Yeah. All bummers. Oops. All bummers. I had a moment when my mom died, and she had skin cancer. It was very quick and very it seemed very quick to me at the time. They probably have more insight into it. My parents did, but you know, it just didn't kind of let on. But I had a moment where I walked in, and my mom had passed, and my dad was just sitting there holding her hand, like sobbing. And I have a very clear, and this is 17 years ago at this point, I have a very clear memory of thinking like, well, I'm in charge now. Like that, this is it. Like I'm the boss now. And it's not to say like I couldn't count on my dad for stuff, but it was very much that feeling of like, okay, you are working without a net at this point. And that's probably the metaphorically the best way I can describe it is like, well, okay, you don't necessarily have the same safety system beneath you that you thought you did before, where whatever choices you made, it would work out fine. And I think that was really the inciting event for that.
Huh. So was it like a generational thing? Like, okay, now I'm the oldest brother and now, you know, the support system that was my parents, that's gone. And now I'm in charge.
Yeah, I think so. And things are a lot fuzzier before that. I mean, there's a lot of choices I made in my life where like, I don't know why I made, like, I don't remember deciding to get my degree in acting directing. It just sort of, I don't know, I do that sometimes, so I guess I'll do this. A much more directed, purposeful, like, okay, if I'm going to do something or I'm going to make a decision or whatever, there are stakes, there are consequences. Like this is part of my story. And I think seeing her story end definitely did sort of put it in context of like, oh, wait a minute, this isn't forever. You know, you need to have some sort of thing that you're trying to achieve or accomplish or what have you.
It's interesting that one, that you took that on, that you kind of took on this, like, now is the time to get serious. Now is the time to do my grand life's work or add some meaning to this, at the same time as, oh shit, I'm terrified of this. Like, the cause acted up at the same time as the anxiety acted up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And then what did you do about that anxiety spike when that happened? Did you get to therapy? Did you treat a vision quest of some sort?
God, it took me forever to get into a therapist, resources in the area being what they were. And I had to find somebody who would basically work for free. So it took months to get in with somebody. And I would say that I treated it much more like someone taking their car into the mechanic. You know, like,
yeah.
Hey, there seems to be a rattling noise. Can you help me with the rattling noise?
What are we looking at? 3 sessions? 4 sessions?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I think I definitely had a day where I was like, well, feeling pretty sane today. Yep. Don't think I'm going to go in.
Yep.
Going to bail on this.
I got to go pop the hood of my brain, let them tinker around, fix me up.
Yeah. Which is how I've done therapy for a lot of my life, is sort of a acute sort of thing. I have tried a lot of different approaches. Transcendental meditation is something that I learned during COVID, which has been very helpful. And I've meditated sort of off and on. I've become, as I get older, I've become more aware of, like, I think I was fixated when I was younger on the idea that I could think my way out of it.
Mm.
I could use the thing that, an intellectualizer. I could use the thing that was broken to fix itself. And it really is kind of counterintuitive in that sense, or maybe it is by definition intuitive, that the broken brain cannot fix the broken brain. Right. So I started to realize how much, like, outside the choices that you make outside of those spikes sort of, like, really impacted me. Things like stupid stuff like getting enough sleep and drinking enough water and exercise and all the things that people, like, tell you to do, and eating fruits and vegetables, which is, you know, is always great. But, like, those sort of, like, exterior things and more macro stuff too, how I've found that if I get very into any sort of, like, video game or television show where it becomes, like, something that's occupying a large portion of my time and I'm doing very little else, that is definitely a trigger for me. Of like, oh, that's gonna, you know, that all, whatever anxiety I'd been delaying is all gonna catch up at once, and I start to feel purposeless and hopeless and stuff like that. But yeah, I take medication every day, which has been great, pretty mild dose, but still, that's what I need, and it's been fantastic. Probably self medicate a little too much with alcohol and marijuana from time to time, but, you know, that's part of the journey. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I got 2 kids. What do you want from me? I'm just trying to make it through.
I got 3. I'm not judging you.
Yeah. But, you know, it really comes and it goes. Do people ever feel like, I feel kind of inauthentic a little bit talking about this so sort of casually and confidently when things are bad? It seems so bad. Like, this would seem so silly. This tone that I've adopted, that it's something that I've, like, completely processed and found a perfect spot for in my, you know, I've pushed the couch into this corner and there it stays. Yeah. And it's just a cute thing. Like, you know, one thing, interesting story.
Here's something quirky about
anxiety.
Me.
Yeah. A fun thing about me, that's crippling anxiety, but I found a perfect place for it. It's right over there and I never have any problems.
Well, I mean, I always get back to the story that Jeff Tweedy told me. Jeff Tweedy from Wilco told me about how he had gone to rehab because he's an addict. He was abusing pills, and he was in this facility where there were some people who were in there too, who, when they got out, they didn't have a home to go to. People in rough shape. He's like, I'm going to get out. I can go on tour and print money, basically.
Yeah.
And he was trying to tell somebody, look, I don't feel like I should complain about any of this. That person, who was, you know, in rougher circumstances, got up into Jeff's face and said, hey, pain is pain. It doesn't matter what your circumstances are. It doesn't matter what you have coming next. It's still the same pain. So I kind of think of that in part because it simplifies things, because it doesn't attach the conditions to it, and it lets you kind of isolate what the problems are a little bit more without that baggage.
Yeah, less. It's been very helpful to me to focus less on curing, fixing, changing, and more on acceptance and understanding and awareness.
Yeah, management.
And management, and knowing, like, if I'm a creep to my wife, if I'm insensitive or irritable, having the wherewithal to step back and say, like, why was that? You know, like, what was that about? Where are you, you know, where are you coming from with this? Because you can't, sometimes it can be very hard to see that. Like, somebody asks, what's wrong? Like, nothing's wrong. Why would you think that? It's like, well, you've been yelling at everybody all day, so I assume something's wrong. Like, hold on, let me think about it. Something is wrong.
Let me retrace those. Sure. Well, and it doesn't let you off the hook for, you know, if you're a jerk, you're a jerk. You can't be a jerk even if you've got anxiety or depression. Yeah. You know, you're still a jerk, but it is helpful to say, okay, what was the inciting incident? What triggered this? And then what distortions did I kind of form along the way to get to this irrational point that I thought was rationality?
Yeah, and I think parenting helps with that a lot too. Helps, or I mean, is maybe a generous term, but like, you know, sorry you don't feel like getting out of bed today, partner, but the diaper's got to get changed. Like, go ahead and get moving. And that can actually be, Joni Mitchell said, the antidote for despair is action. And I feel like that has been one of the things that has actually been really helpful to me. And I heard that long before I had kids, but it's definitely this idea of like, okay, mentally you don't feel great right now, but you're not going to think your way out of that. So like, it, just getting into motion, getting to work on something, moving forward on something, anything, if you can, if you're in a place to do that, I think has been something that served me really well.
A big part of managing something like anxiety or depression or a lot of these other things is spotting your own distortions, where there's your thinking process and it can lead you to a kind of messed up place. It can lead you to an unhealthy place because you get in patterns of thinking. Have you been able to flag those for yourself?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with too much comparison and a demand for perfection and self-doubt in myself, which is like, it's weird if you know my work to think that I have any aspirations towards, you know, perfectionism or, you know, but it's more, it's, I have this sort of brain where it doesn't propel me to, you know, it's not like Mozart where the need for perfection like drives me towards making perfect works. It just leads me to be overly critical of the stuff that I do. It's not so strong that I can like, you know, harness it to make like pristine, beautiful things. But, you know, I tear myself down a lot, you know, and that is a very unhelpful path. You know, I will make something and think, well, it's not as good as this other thing, or the best things I'm going to make are in the past. Like the idea that like, I've already made the best things I'm going to make, which is like, based on what? Yeah. I don't know. You know, like, I don't, cause I'm 41 and I feel like, well, that's, you know, that's it. That's it. That my best stuff is behind me, which is like, is literally like, it takes about 10 seconds of challenging that thought of, you know, 10 seconds of CBT before you're like, wait a minute, hold on.
You're not
like,
an Olympic sprinter. It's
exactly right. Well, yes, exactly. Not a gymnast. It's not like they're hauling my jersey into the rafters after 8 seasons of great NBA play. Yeah. Like, it's not, you know, they'll let old white dudes talk into microphones for the rest of their lives. Nobody's going to come take the mic out of my hands.
Yeah, you're not going to lose a step. You know, your tongue's not going to weaken to the point where you can't compete.
I'll just do a lot more end of life care insurance ads. Like, you know, you don't want to leave your family with concerns. If prostates are important, let's talk about.
Yeah, it. Yeah. Ask your doctor if this is right for you. Coming up, Justin can talk about mental health and joke about it now, but it wasn't always that way. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best. Because obviously, there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh.
Back with Justin McElroy of Mabim Bam. I asked Justin if mental health got discussed in the McElroy house growing up.
No. And I don't criticize my parents for that. I mean, my dad definitely has, I think, started to in recent years, when several of us have opened up about our mental health, realized that some of the things that he kind of took as quirk or personality, you know, earlier in his life, had he been sort of like had our dialogue about that as a society, not as a family, been a little bit more healthy, that he maybe would have flagged some stuff early on. But no, and I don't, in a way that I think is very common for a family in the 80s. I mean, the idea that mental illness would be something that, like, it was a very othering sort of, like, you know, these are crazy people,
right?
And they're sane people. And that's the idea, that maybe you just need a little help from time to time, or that it's just part of.
Yeah, I don't think I'm Napoleon, so therefore it's
exactly
not
right. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I don't talk to someone in my head, so obviously I'm not, you know, quote, I'm doing air quotes as if that's helpful on a podcast. I don't normally say crazy, so you have to understand the context under through which I am
putting the bunny puppets that, but, up around it.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So yeah, so it wasn't a thing for mostly for cultural reasons.
Now, I will say, though, that my family did, and he's been very open about this, so I don't feel like I'm telling tales out of school, but my family did recognize Travis's ADHD at a very young age and got him the help that he needed with that. So, you know, I'm probably counteracting my they just didn't pay enough attention to me, John. Maybe that's what I'm getting at. But no, it was,
I think, like, we've made a breakthrough here today.
Yeah, right. So they weren't waving anything away, waving mental health away, but it was, you know, it was not something that, you know, something that's a bit more mild, like my particular flavor, or at least it seems mild in comparison. It wouldn't have necessarily, like, rang the alarm bells.
What does it do for someone with anxiety to make your living being yourself in the public sphere? You talked about this social anxiety that you had, and yet your whole gig is being yourself and having millions of people listen to you. Does that
millions? I wish. Yeah, that would go down smooth. Well,
aggregated over many years, yeah, let's say millions. Yeah. But what does that do to your anxiety, knowing that people are listening to you, and that your job is to, you know, you're not making spoons, you're not flying an airplane, you're being yourself. What does that do to your anxiety?
There are pluses and negatives. I think one thing that's really nice is that whenever I talk about my own struggles or just quirks or whatever weird brain stuff I've going on, I am met with a chorus of people who are like, I completely recognize this pattern of behavior. This is not, you know, it may be atypical in the grand scheme of things, but like there's 10 of us that do the exact same thing. Like you are not alone in that case. And that is very, that's very nice. I think that my family and my dad and us have always had a tendency to want to fix things immediately. If there's a hurt, if there's a pain, if there's discomfort, whatever, it's hard for us to do anything else while that's sort of hanging in the air. My brothers and my dad and I do not have multi-day fights. It is like, let's argue about this right now and then move past it. And that is my impulse with a lot of stuff. I want the fix. I want it fixed. I am focused on nothing else until it is fixed. And I think that if there is a negative side, it is because I have to do this weekly or, you know, multiple times a week, that if something is changing in me or an opinion is evolving or I'm having some sort of like problem, it becomes very tempting to try to compartmentalize it and solve it and put a name on it and, you know, move on from it in a way that I feel like I can't back down from. If my opinions about something change or my feelings about myself change or whatever, you know, that's not something I can sort of hash out in a public space. So I have a much more defined, I mean, the other thing about me is like, I have a much clearer defined interiority, you know, than I did when I started doing this. I mean, there is the parts of me that I feel comfortable like sharing with people, and it's a very large part of who I am. And then there's parts that like I know that I'm not as comfortable sitting with in a public space, and that are a little bit rockier, a little more jagged, and those are things that I tend to keep to, not to myself, but to, you know, my close friends and wife and occasionally therapist.
What has that process been then of building those boundaries? Because that is so hugely important. You can't just, you know, if you're completely naked to the world, that's very hazardous. So what was the process of building those boundaries?
I think it was largely trial and error, in the sense that if I was going to talk about something, it had to pass a test of, do I have something that I'm adding here? Am I helping with this by bringing this to the forefront? And do I feel comfortable enough in my feelings on this that I'm willing to like to share it in that kind of way? I think my thoughts, like having kids was definitely a big part of this, because there was suddenly this part of my life that like, I don't know who I am as a dad. I don't know what it's like to have kids. I don't know how much of my kids' lives they want like broadcasted out. And that was definitely sort of the other sort of big inciting incident of that was like, I need to keep something to myself because these people may not want to have every detail of their life. Now, that's not to say I don't talk about them constantly now, but it's definitely something that I had to like think about and sit with and develop some opinions on. So
how old are your kids?
They are 7 and 4.
Okay. Do they have an awareness of what you do for a living and compare that to maybe what other dads do for a living?
My 4-year-old does wish that I would get a job. Uh-huh. That would be, yeah, she would be very excited. Charlie, my 7-year-old, we have done some like YouTube podcasting together, not on video, but just sort of us talking and then running the audio on YouTube, the Charlie and Daddy show, as we call it. And so she likes to talk about like her fans and McElroy fans. And, you know, she very much grew up in a world where people will routinely come up to me and talk to me as if they know me, mm-hmm. and about like my work and stuff. And that was very, it's funny because I was very comfortable with that because it happened to my dad. My dad was a radio guy for 40 years in the local area. So like people would constantly come up to us, and people ask me now, like, do you get recognized a lot in Huntington? I said, yeah, I get recognized as there's Clint's son. Like, right. That's how I get recognized in Huntington. So it's like not weird to me either. Like, she's definitely like aware of it. and thinks it's cool. They like to watch. Our listeners will sometimes make like animatics or cartoons based on our audio, and they love to watch those and see, you know, daddy's work there. But yeah, they know. I think that they, it's a weird enough career that even I struggled to encapsulate it to people when they ask me what I do for a living.
Yeah.
But I think they get it as much as they can.
Family dynamics can be really tricky when it comes to mental health, because not everybody approaches things the same way, even if they come from the same environment growing up. Working so closely with members of your family, does that have any effect on your efforts to manage things like your anxiety?
I think it does. It provides a good impetus. And my kids do this now, but before then, it is a good impetus for, like, I'm the sort of person, I think a lot of people with mental illness feel this way, where I definitely get the occasional impulse to just, like, really lean into it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if I'm feeling down, there's a part of me that's just like, let's just see how bad it'll get. And I don't mean, and I know that sounds terrible, but that's the, you know what I mean? Like, that's the impulse. I should just quit. I should really lean into this. Maybe it will lead to some greater simplicity in my life. You know what I mean? If I quit everything I'm doing, maybe I'll just walk the world and be a vigilante or something. I don't know what my plan is. Kung I don't fu. Have life skill. Yeah, exactly.
Mercenary of some sort.
But, you know, when you have your brothers depending on you for, like, their career and your career, like, there's definitely an impetus to, like, oh, you gotta get better. Like, you have to, you can't sit like this in it. You gotta move past it. But they have been equally good at, you know, if we're supposed to record and someone is having a bad mental health day, like, we both have to respect. I mean, what choice do we have but to respect it?
Do you feel an obligation to have that bad mental health day out loud into a microphone, or do you put on an act on those days?
It depends. There have definitely been days where, like, I'm in a bad enough headspace where I have to say, like, hey, listen, I can't do it today. I try to be more proactive so I don't get into that scenario. You know, if I'm headed towards a rough patch, at this point, like, I have coping strategies. I have things that I can do because I have these people that depend on me. Like, I have things that I can do to try to, like, cut it off before it gets to that point. But, you know, sometimes the things are too loud and you gotta, there have been times where if I'm pretty hyped up, but not about specific things, I can occasionally use that. Like, sometimes that's an energy that is, it can be kind of fun to work out on a microphone and as a kind of therapy, right? Like, I'm a big believer in the idea that, like, your body, there's a lot more of your physicality involved with mental health than you think about, like, your body kind of storing up a lot of that kind of energy. And I feel like sometimes when the Greeks talk about tragedy, they would call it the expurgation of pity and fear. I think sometimes you can kind of do that into a microphone, like, hey, here's where I'm at today. This is the kind of day I'm having. Let's, if that stops being fun or funny, which it has happened before, where it's like, this is excessively, you know, acerbic or dark or what have you. Sometimes it doesn't work out, but sometimes it can be something you can work with if it's a bit more mild and general and what have you. There was a lot of times when there was like a global malaise around, oh, like, November 2016 let me check my watch, now, but that, like, you know, everybody of good character was feeling kind of bummed out. It's so weird to go back and listen to, if you ever, like, go back and do, like, large listens of podcasts. I'm struggling to not say binge because I think it's a terrible bit of nomenclature we accept as a society, but if you ever listen consecutively through a podcast, there's always a point where you get to that period and it's like you could just feel the bottom drop out of the whole thing,
the,
like,
soul,
oh,
shudder,
God, yeah, I remember it. This was brutal, yeah, oh yeah, that was rough. But that's the kind of thing where, like, okay, we have to, you know, my Twitter bio is a Charles Dickens quote that I cribbed from Elizabeth Gilbert. It's, I feel an earnest and humble desire and shall till I die to increase the stock of harmless cheerfulness. And that's like, you got to do it now. Like, if that's your thing, like, this is the moment that people need it. So find a way to get it out. Yeah. So that's been, you know, double-edged sword, but I think more positive than anything.
Speaking of Twitter and times that were very trying for people. Christmas 2020, you tweet, "My mental health is the worst it has ever been in my whole life. I haven't hugged a lot of people I love in nearly a year. And frankly, friends, I'm done. Also, I feel like everybody's going through it, so I can't rely much on others, and there's nothing I can do to make it better." Pretty well put, but...
Oh, man, you forget that that stuff is on there for a long time.
It's on the permanent record. Tell me where you were in that space.
When was it?
That was about a year into COVID on Christmas, yeah. December 25th, 2020.
Oh, yeah. I stand by all that. Of course, I felt that way. Holidays are really hard for me, to be honest. My mom was a big Christmas person and a big sort of like holiday person in general. And when I see the kids going through like the holiday celebrations, and it makes me think about how she never got to meet them. And it's always like it's always trying. And I want to make it good for, so it's a dual stress of like, I can't just be like, oh, fucking Christmas. You know what I mean? I can't fully Grinch out because I have two little kids. So, and I like it, you know, like I do. It's bittersweet. I like that time of year. But so that was rough. But also, like, I live in an area where people kind of move past the social distancing, you know, avoiding gathering. They move past that real quick, and they started gathering a lot earlier than anybody said you should be gathering. So it became this like constant, I mean, literally constant daily scroll through Facebook and see 10 people out at a restaurant or whatever, doing these things that I have not done for, I mean, at that point, 9 months, but it's, you know, however long after that. And like that sort of dual jealousy meets frustration is just very trying. And also, the other parts of that I hadn't fully compartmentalized, I think at that point, is that the stuff that I make is recorded into a microphone in a vacuum, like you and I are doing here. And then it's released to people. And, you know, when I was doing shows regularly, you would see those people that were enjoying the stuff that you make, and it would feel a lot more real. And there are many long stretches during COVID where I wasn't seeing anybody that listened to the things that I make, and I didn't feel any sort of impact, you know, that I was having in the world. And that was like really, and also like I have less going on than I've ever had in my entire life, and I have nothing to talk about, and I don't find any of this funny. And it's like, that was, you know, the constant sort of daily vibe for me. Yeah. So and I think also like my brothers couldn't come in around then too, which is always a Christmas thing, you know, doing our candle night shows and stuff like that. When we were touring regularly, I would see them every month, and our kids would play together, and, you know, cause we all live in different places, and, you know, losing that, was a big one. This one is embarrassing, but like, I do need to say it. Like, there's a part of me where it felt like professionally we had a lot of things going, and it was like our careers, if you want to call it that, were like going in a good direction. There was like a couple of different TV shows and movies that we were like set to start doing, and it fell, those all, you know, very quickly fell through. And it's this sense of like, well, this is like 2 years of like, you know, that I'm not getting back, like that we're not growing, and what am I missing out on? You know, how long do we have this window where people actually care about what we do? And so that was like, I really felt the loss of that. And that's so stupid and selfish and petty because so many other people lost so much more and were suffering so much more. But like, I don't know, pain is pain.
Pain is pain.
So pain is pain.
I mean, it's interesting because I think everybody, not everybody, but I think a lot of people kind of have this sense of their public profile versus their private life more than they used to with the advent of social media. I mean, you select the version of yourself that you want to put on Facebook or on Instagram or whatever it is. And your family is kind of in an enhanced version of that because you have a much bigger audience and because you work together. And it introduces the concept of the parasocial relationship where a lot of people are listening to you and feeling like you're their friend, but you have never met them. You don't know who they are. And in something like anxiety or any kind of personal mental health situation, what does that do to you? What does that do to your sense of anxiety, knowing that people see you as a friend, even though you don't know them?
It's tough. You know, you get used to it at shows and stuff because it happens enough that you just kind of roll with it. You know, like you can get used to anything if you did it enough times. And I had enough people coming up to me, like speaking to me as though they, like they would remember things that I didn't remember that I had talked about. It's like, they would make like a joke reference to something that I had said at some point. It's like, I listen.
Yeah.
If this, as I always say about podcasting, if this stuff was good, I would write it down. You know, it's not, I'm just kind of talking into a microphone. I don't know. So that was weird, but you get used to it. And it's kind of nice because it feels like, you know, I got friends in the room with me, and that can be, you know, most of our listeners, like almost without exception, are nice, generous, cool people and who I enjoy spending time with. I think that where it gets into trouble and where I definitely got into trouble is it was like feeling a sense of responsibility for people. Like, I don't think people don't realize, like, we are generously like D tier internet celebrities. And I like cannot tell you how many emails we've gotten from people who were very, very low. I mean, at the lowest possible point that they could be and contemplating perhaps ending their lives or whatever, and that hurt, you know, the anger, the frustration, the sadness, especially on social media, has only increased. And it really got to a point where, as much as I would like to be the person who is like supporting anybody who needs it, I can't. I mean, I just don't have the juice. I don't have it in the tank. And I have a family that I have to take care of before all of that. And I just don't have it. And I think that in setting up that parasocial relationship, which I think we really fostered early on, when we couldn't be that, or when I couldn't be that, I think it upset some people. Like it was a frustrating, you know, feeling like we, you know, when we did things like leave our social media pages and things like that, you know, I think that there was a sense of loss there, a sense of hurt, but especially because we are like funded by listeners. I was always worried that people were only supporting us because we were like nice to them.
Like on a one-on-one basis?
Exactly. I mean, yeah, that's not that far off. I mean, that people just sort of like took pity or just liked us like as people. And that if we did anything to sort of like pull back, then we would lose all of that. Like, because it wasn't that we were like funny or entertaining. It was just sort of people felt like bad for us or something, or felt like they were.
You've built a pity empire.
Kind of stupid to say it out loud, but it's like, I don't know. That's kind of, that's a self-doubt, I guess. But that was my genuine belief was that if we tried to make any sort of boundaries, that we would lose everything. I mean, we would lose our careers. So
how did you recover from that thinking, or have you?
Just in continuing to make work. I had to get good at looking at the work I'm making and making my own decision about whether it's worthwhile. Because Sid and I talk about this, my wife Sydney and I talk about this all the time, that if you believe the bad stuff on the internet, you have to believe the good. Like, if you believe the good stuff on the internet, you have to believe the bad stuff too. So the only sane choice is not to believe any, not listen to any of it. I'm talking about criticism in this case, not like WebMD.
Yeah.
Like, if you accept the good criticism, you have to accept the bad stuff too. And really the only thing, and that can be useful sometimes, right? Sometimes you need a little bit of that. But for me, I had to get really good at saying, like, I think this is worthwhile. I like this. I liked this thing. That has to be enough.
Let me ask you this. You seem to have a rule that if you accept the good stuff, you have to accept the bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, I guess my logic is that if I'm...
Because there's no referee, there's no scorekeeper.
Yeah, but...
It's just the chaos of the world, and I would suggest maybe you don't have to accept the bad stuff. You can just accept the good stuff.
Maybe, well, okay, what if I more accurately said, in opening myself to the good things, I will also see the bad things. The internet has not invented a cool way for me to automatically filter all the, hey, listen, if I could set up a Twitter that was all positive vibes for me, I'd be on it 24 hours a day. Don't get me wrong. But no, I mean, yeah, you're right. But it's like, I know my own internal critic well enough to know that I know the ones I'm going to listen to. I know what's going to worm its way into my psyche and like live there rent free, as the kids, as the kids say. So I try to be my own arbiter of if I'm making stuff that I like. When we get to the end of an episode, I have a pretty good sense of whether or not it was good or not. I have a pretty good sense of whether or not it was, we did a good job.
Good by whether it fits your vision, your taste of what you wanted to make, or good in terms of it will be approved by your fans.
Good in terms of I had fun making it.
Okay.
And that has
been a good barometer.
Yeah. I won't lie and say that when I make something that's a little bit like newer or stranger, that I look for approval, outside approval still. So that is still part of me. You know, I like anybody like still seek out approbation and praise, but you know, I'm at a point now where if I make something that doesn't have a big impact, but I liked it, I made a video series with my friend Dwight called Taste of Luxury that was us trying to recreate luxury experiences in Huntington where we live, and it didn't set the world on fire. In fact, the network that we made it for decided they would rather not have it even after they paid for it. Okay, guys, it seems like free. All it's right there. Let me put it on my YouTube channel. That's fine. But like, I liked it. It makes me laugh. And that is enough. And I really do mean that. Like that really is enough for me at this point, that like, I do not let criticism make me feel worse about something than I do. I just sort of try to judge it by, I liked it. It suits what I'm trying to do. And, you know, if there's things I can do a little better next time, sure. But, you know, I try not to get too many in my head about it.
So we've talked about what the anxiety was when you were a kid. We talked about, you know, how it hit when you were starting to have kids and how it hit in COVID on a very grim Christmas day.
Yeah.
Where is it today?
I think that I am... It's been good lately because I am doing a lot. I find that it's best when I have a lot of things that I'm doing at once. So my wife is running for office here in West Virginia for the House of Delegates here. So I've been spending a lot of time doing that. I'm growing blackberries and raspberries and pear trees. I made brownies before we came down here. I'm about to start building bookcases for my wife's office upstairs, and I have a lot of things like that going on, and I find that things are better when I'm learning and when I'm doing new stuff and when I'm working. I find that that's when things are best. And we're about to start doing shows more regularly again, so I'm looking forward to that. But so yeah, in all those regards, it's pretty good today. So today, okay. Today, all is well, or as well as well gets around here.
We'll take the win.
Yeah.
Justin McElroy, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.
Justin McElroy is great. So are his brothers, spouses, fathers, children, the whole army, really. I have thoughts on the conversation we just had right after this. Welcome back. Here are four quick thoughts on the Justin McElroy interview. 1, the word approbation appeared in my talk with Faith Saley on the last episode of this podcast, and it appeared in this talk with Justin. I can't remember the word approbation appearing on any other interview I've done now 2 weeks in a row. It's hot boy approbation summer. Two, Justin does a really healthy thing in this talk where he recognizes his mental disorder. He doesn't minimize it, but he doesn't let it roam free either. He knows what distortions it will cause, and so he's ready. That's a good thing to do. Three, this idea of if I read the nice things about me, I have to read the mean things too. Ugh, I wish that idea would go away. I wish people would stop thinking like that. Die, that idea, die, because you don't have to read the mean things at all. You could just stick with the good things. There are no obligations. There are no rules. Four, I don't know if hot coffee poured on ice cubes is a West Virginia thing or what kind of thing it is. When we hit our goal during that Max Fun Drive I talked about, I also promised that I'd make a video where I interview puppies about mental health. And I did that at an animal shelter here in Minnesota. The puppies' names were Hermes and Demeter. There's a video, just as I promised, on our show page. Here's an audio preview from that video.
Yeah. How about therapy? Have you had good experiences with therapy? Negative experiences? I mean, the important thing is that you try things. Okay. Demeter, I'm getting a lot of, it's anger, but I think it's, I think there's some pain there too. Well, no, maybe there isn't any at all.
Both those puppies have found homes. And Laura House is here for a meditation moment. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
How important for these things, how important during some basic meditation is it to sit a certain way? May I slump or should I have my spine completely aligned? How crucial is that?
Yes, sit as rigid as possible. No, it is actually good to have your back supported and you're sitting up. Sometimes I forget to, because I want it to be very cool and loose and easy. And you don't have to be rigid and you don't have to like sort of hold your hand in a certain way or, but we do kind of want your head upright. So as opposed to like, if your head was in your hands at your desk, like you don't really want your head forward and you don't want it way, way back. So you just kind of sit comfortably, ideally with like some kind of seat with a back and your head up, but comfortable. And if you're meditating and like you get an itch, you can scratch it. If you, your leg is in a certain pose and you want to move it. Move it. You know, you're not meant to feel like rigid, like frozen statues.
Right. There's no law enforcement coming.
Get comfy, get loose. I feel like we can take it on as a horrible thing we're supposed to do and don't, and we just feel bad about it. We do it or we don't do it and we feel bad. And it really isn't. It really can be like that cozy little sweet nap that's always there for you if you want it.
Oh, okay. Enough talk. Bring it on. Now I'm really hungry for it.
So just sit comfortably. Again, back supported, head up, but not in any formal way. And close your eyes. And just notice your breath. You're not trying to change it. You're not concentrating on it. It's already happening. And you're just quietly noticing it. And you'll have thoughts. So notice your breath. And as you have thoughts, your attention will sometimes go into your thoughts, which is natural. And when you're aware of it, just bring your attention back to your breath again. Just let go. See what happens. You can go ahead and open your eyes slowly. Hello.
Hello.
It's a nice little checkout.
You know, if I concentrate on my breath, I don't so much worry about my posture, which is a good thing. Funny trick, that.
Yeah, and hopefully not all the other things. It's like you give your mind just a little job. Oh, breath. Like you're not getting bills or whatever in there.
Right. I review every embarrassing thing I ever said to a person.
Exactly. No.
Don't need that.
Just breath. It's all right.
Laura House is the co-host of the Tiny Victories podcast here on Maximum Fun. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
Next time on Depression Mode, when she was a kid and writing down every single thing in every room that she was ever in, everyone thought it was cute. Like, oh, she wants to be a reporter one day. Nobody thought, oh, she has obsessive compulsive disorder.
It was like a very private embarrassment because it's like my family didn't even know what I was writing down. They thought I was like writing stories and ideas and not this like, you know, cryptex of second graders' outfits.
Jamie Loftus joins us. If people support our show, we can keep having a show. That's the way this works. If you've already supported Depression Mode, thank you. We appreciate it. You have created this with us. If you haven't yet, that's okay. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join. Find a level that works for you and help us out. Be sure to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write effusive reviews about us. All that helps get the message of the show out. It gets people talking about mental health, which is why we make the show. I want you to know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free. 1-800-273-8255 or 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text HOME to 741-741. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org if you want to get in touch. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. Our Depression Mode newsletter is on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter @JohnMoe. Hi, credits listeners. My office is in the basement of our house because the acoustics are really good down there. No ambient sound, no cars passing by or lousy, obnoxious birds like we have here in the Midwest. But a friend of mine recently said, John, maybe working in the basement all day talking about depression isn't the healthiest thing you could be doing. So I'm working on looking into some other options. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings. He is the singer of the band Old 97s. And if you don't listen to the Old 97s, go listen to the Old 97s. And if you do already, go listen to them some more because they're great. And Rhett's nice.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now. Building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason. Maybe there's no reason. I just keep believing. No one knows the answer. Maybe there's no answer. I just keep on dancing.
Hi, this is Elizabeth from Monterey, California, here to remind you that your best really is good enough.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.